Every second Wednesday of the month from 6 to 9 is Women in Crew Night at the Bike Kitchen. Bring your bike and give it some love in this safe and positive space for anyone who identifies as female or queer. Come learn how to fix your own bike with the help of a female or queer-identified mechanic and volunteers. Plus, there's free pizza. Visit bikecoop.ca for more information.
Are you interested in Indigenous issues? Do you get ticked off with ongoing colonization? Do you have something to say? Or do you want to learn more? We have just the thing. Join UBC's first ever Indigenous radio collective at CITR Radio, Unceded Musqueam Territories. Our show, Unceded Airwaves, airs every Monday from 11 to 12, and we meet from 12 to 1 to plan our upcoming shows. We're interested in content covering various things from film to literature, current day politics, history, whatever you want to talk about, we're into it. Everyone welcome, Indigenous and non-Indigenous.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
Coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Welcome back. Today is Friday, March 11th. I'm Sam Moore.
And I'm Eva Yuguen-Senj. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to the listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5.08 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
To start off the show, we have News 101 co-director Rohit Joseph's interview with Julia Hanlon, brewmaster at Steamworks Brewing, and was broadcast on International Women's Day as part of a special segment on women in science.
Following that, we have News 101 co-director Emily Blake's piece on the controversial pro-life protest taking place on campus this week.
Then we have Rohit Joseph's interview Darren Dahl, Senior Associate Dean of Faculty at UBC's Sauder School of Business and a professor of the school's Marketing and Behavioral Sciences Division. Dahl is one of the co-authors of study which found it that ethical shopping is funded by welfare checks. Those shoppers are judged as immoral for taking advantage of public generosity.
We also have Rohit Joseph's interview. Oh, that's written twice.
To finish off the show, we have News 101's financial correspondent, Alex Norman, bringing you his latest financial update.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, pro-life club interrupted by protesters. On Wednesday, UBC Lifeline, the pro-life club on campus, was confronted by protesters angry at their displays, which featured a swastika. The club had set up displays and were handing out pamphlets in front of the Frederick Lasserre building. Protesters repeatedly chanted for UBC Lifeline to take down posters that seemed to compare abortion with the Holocaust and the Cambodian genocide. Protesters said the comparison was inaccurate and offensive. One of the female protesters, self-identifying as a professor, described the posters as hate speech. According to Mark Goody, a student member of the pro-life club, the posters were not meant to equate abortion with genocide. He said, quote, When people are killed from abortion, they're killed because their humanity is taken away. Goudian noted that UBC Lifeline has put on similar displays on campus since 2001. UBC security was present at the scene to prevent violent conflict but remained neutral. Barry Eckleton, head of the campus security, said that, quote, "The understanding is that these demonstrations are peaceful, that they respect others, but we allow any groups to come provided they're respectful." Later on Wednesday, the AMS released a statement against the pro-life activists, condemning the triggering nature of their displays.
In local news, Maple Batalia's killer sentenced to life in prison. After 4.5 years, Gurjinder Gary Dhaliwal was sentenced for the second-degree murder of the 19-year-old SFU student. Dhaliwal was sentenced to life in prison with no chance of parole for 21 years by Justice Terrence Schultz. Batalia was murdered around 1 a.m. near SFU's Surrey campus in September 2011. Maple's sister, Rosaline, said, quote, "We won't get her back, but it definitely will help with the healing process." The case has raised attention to the issue of teen dating violence in Canada. Dhaliwal became obsessive and controlling after Maple tried to end their relationship. He texted her thousands of times, confronted her male acquaintances, and became violent. Crown Prosecutor Wendy Stevens said, quote, "In this country, of course, men do not get to impose themselves on women." In honor of Maple, the Batalia family has created a bursary for women studying health sciences at SFU.
Syrian refugees share hotel with furries. The 5th annual Vancouver Convention was held at the Executive Airport Plaza Hotel in Richmond. More than 800 furries attended, or people fascinated by fictional animal characters with human traits. Organizers warned attendees that Syrian refugees were also staying at the hotel as temporary housing. They passed out cards to convention attendees that read, "A major concern that Vancouver has is ensuring that each and every one of the refugees and attendees feels welcome and safe, and the fact that this is likely to be a major culture shock to them." However, children loved the costumes, playing and taking photos with the convention members, and participating in the final dance. Furry Chris Jantz said, quote, "They saw people in giant animal costumes. To the children, they were just cartoons from stuff like Yo Gabba Gabba, and they wanted to say hi. I don't think they had any concept of the furry fandom." Vancouver is Western Canada's largest convention for furries. Media portrayals have presented furries as a fetish community, but members say this ignores the less sensational elements of the community. After reaching the goal of bringing 25,000 Syrian refugees to Canada, authorities are trying to find housing for the 60% of refugees who do not have permanent housing.
In national news, Canadian banknote to feature a woman in 2018, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and Finance Minister Bill Morneau made the historic announcement on International Women's Day. Morneau said, quote, "In our country's nearly 150-year history, women, with the notable exception of the Queen, have been largely unrepresented on our banknotes." Morneau added, quote, "In 2018, we will bring real change to a new generation of women who will carry with them constant reminders that they are not only Canada's future, but a celebrated part of our history." The Bank of Canada is asking the public to nominate women for the honor. Nominees must be Canadian women who have demonstrated outstanding leadership, achievement, or distinction, benefiting Canadians or in the service of Canada. Nominees must also have been dead for at least 25 years, and fictional characters are not allowed. Submissions can be made to the bank's website until April 15th.
In international news, Romania makes all state finances public. Prime Minister Dacian Ciolos made the decision in order to fight corruption. The new program makes monthly budget data available for around 17,720 institutions, including parliament, ministries, city halls, schools, and hospitals. Ciolos said, quote, "This transparency should remove risks of fraud or corruption, because what money is being spent on and how much one investment or another costs will become much more transparent." Romania is perceived as one of the EU's most corrupt member states. Anti-corruption prosecutors in the country have been cracking down on high-level graft. A disclosure program financed by EU development funds revealed overpriced public works contracts exchanged for bribes, tax evasion, and fraudulent handling of EU development funds and subsidies.
In other international news, Mr. Trudeau goes to Washington. This week, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau visited the White House in the first visit by a Canadian leader in nearly 20 years. Trudeau and President Obama traded jokes and shared a lavish meal at the White House state dinner in what is being billed the biggest political bromance between the two countries' leaders. One of the more memorable jokes between the two leaders was a debate about hockey in which Obama said, quote, "Where's the Stanley Cup now?" Trudeau replied by pointing out that the team's top three players, Jonathan Toews, Duncan Keith, and Patrick Sharp, who is now with the Dallas Stars, are all Canadian. Even Toronto's Grammy-winning R&B star, The Weeknd, made an appearance at an after-party held at the Smithsonian's Renwick Gallery. In Washington, Mr. Trudeau chose his words carefully after being asked by reporters for his views on U.S.-Canada relations under a Donald Trump or Ted Cruz presidency. He said he looked forward to working with whomever U.S. voters elected to the White House.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
UBC Mental Health Awareness Club is hosting the annual Defeat Depression Run at UBC, with proceeds going towards club and community mental health support and services. Come out on March 12th to participate in the 5-kilometer run or walk. There will be prizes for top fundraiser. For more information or to register online and start pledging, visit the UBC Mental Health Awareness Club on Facebook and learn how you can make a difference in your community.
Listen up, dears. The UBC Players Club is turning 100.
This isn't your GMA's celebration.
We're the oldest club on campus, and we think it's time to shake things up a little with two amazing shows.
YOLO!
You can find all the details on the Google or via the interweb at ubcplayersclub.com.
Respect your elders and come out and help us ring in a new century of amazing theater.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Right now we have News 101 co-director Rohit Joseph's interview with Julia Hanlon, brewmaster at Steamworks Brewing, and was broadcast on International Women's Day as part of a special segment on Women in Science.
Does Discorder magazine sum?
When you think of a brewmaster, the first image that probably comes to Brewmaster is every bit as attainable for a woman as it is for a man. I talked to Julia over the phone to get her take on the state of BC's craft beer scene and to understand how she paved her own path in a male-dominated industry. Hi, is this Julia?
Yes.
Hi, this is Rohit. I was the UBC student who had emailed you.
Oh, okay. Yeah, hi. I was expecting you.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to do this again. Really appreciate that. I was just really interested that there is this International Women's Day event on March 8th. And I just kind of wanted to, before I even get into that, though, I just kind of wanted to learn a bit about how you got into brewing craft beer. What made you fall in love with it?
Well, I suppose it started, I myself went to UBC. So I would say my love of beer started when I was a university student. I drank a lot of beer in university, and I was doing my degree in chemical and biological engineering, and as it turned out, that had a lot to do with fermentation and fermentation processes. So when I graduated, I decided to pursue a job in the brewing industry so I could sort of marry up two things that I enjoyed doing. I actually started, I spent 10 years with Molson. I'm not sure if you knew that.
No.
So I started my career with Molson, and they had a program called the Production Trainee Program, and they were hiring essentially, you know, entry-level new graduates out of engineering-type disciplines. And so that's how I got hired. And that program was like almost 2-year brewing apprenticeship. So I worked in every part of the brewery from, you know, raw materials coming in to packaged goods going out the door, and even things like distribution and procurement of materials, so literally everything in that 2 years. And I got the opportunity to work in 2 breweries. And at the end of the 2 years, I wrote my diploma in brewing through the Institute of Brewing and Distilling, which is kind of like one avenue of education for brewers. So I did that. And then I've been working in the industry ever since. So I think the leap from, you know, a big multinational brewer to the craft industry, something that I had always kind of dreamed of, but it's really only become a reality in BC in the last few years that craft brewing has just exploded. And there's just so many opportunities for really anybody who wants to be a brewer to get involved in it.
Yeah, so
as I say, when I started, the only brewery or one of the few breweries in town was the Molson Brewery. So.
Yeah, okay, so that was like one of the only few avenues you could even brew.
Exactly. I mean, other than homebrewing, but as a career.
As a career, I mean, yeah. So how did you end up stumbling into Steamworks? It is a very recent opportunity, I presume, because like you said, the craft beer scene has just been exploding in the last 2 years.
I've actually been with Steamworks since last May, so it hasn't been a very long time. But as I said, it sort of going into the craft industry was, you know, something of a dream of mine.
Yeah.
And it just so happened that they had an opportunity. The old brewmaster that was here, he was from Australia, and he happened to be moving back to Australia. So there was an opening, and it was kind of a right place at the right time kind of thing. And it was just sort of the perfect opportunity for me.
Awesome. So, Julia, I was talking to Joe Weeb, actually, and he's the co-founder of Victoria Beer Week, and he was telling me one of the big reasons, at least that he believes that that craft beer has been getting really big, is because more women are actually enjoying the taste of craft beer. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think beer knows a gender. I think everybody can enjoy craft beer, and I think just there's so much variety that craft beer brings into the marketplace. There's so much choice. So whether you want to drink a light lager, you want to drink a big IPA, a sour, there's just so much variety. I think there's pretty much something for everyone, man, woman, you know, doesn't really matter.
Do you think there are any particular barriers for women entering the craft brewing industry as a brewmaster?
You know, I get asked this question a lot, or some version of this question quite a bit. And I can only speak from my personal experience working in the brewing industry. And I would say that, you know, I personally haven't encountered any barriers, you know, being a woman in the industry. And I think if a woman wants to become a brewer, then I think the opportunity exists. And, you know, just with the sheer number of breweries that have popped up in BC in the last couple of years, there are opportunities out there, and there's certainly no one stopping anyone from being part of it.
Although you did mention that you came from a pretty science-heavy background, and I guess one of the things that people say a lot is that there needs to be more women in the STEM program. So, you know, UBC, is, as you probably know, is always trying to actively recruit and encourage more women to to join those kind of disciplines, or to, you know, study in those disciplines. What would your advice be to somebody who may be like wanting to get into it, but they're intimidated by the technical knowledge that's required?
Well, gosh, that's a tough question. I don't even really know. I mean,
like, what made you
not,
so?
It's not something that intimidated me. Personally, I mean, I've always been interested in science and biology, and so it seemed like a natural progression for me to pursue an engineering degree. And there's, you know, I feel like there's enough women doing those things that it wasn't intimidating to me. Like, there was, I think in chemical engineering in my year, it was pretty close to actually half female.
Oh, wow. what year would that have been approximately?
I graduated in 2004.
Okay, yeah, so not too long ago.
About 10 years ago, yeah.
That's pretty impressive, actually, that it was almost equal even in 2004.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm not sure if chemical and biological engineering is just a discipline that, you know, women naturally are more drawn to or what the case may be, because, I mean, the split in, electrical engineering, there was far fewer women, but for whatever reason, there is quite a few in chemical.
So now going into Victoria Beer Week, what do you plan on sharing with the audience there for drinking the story?
I've never been asked to do anything quite like that before, so I'm kind of excited and a little bit nervous. But I think I think I'm going to talk just about my career path in the brewing industry. Some of the key, I guess, defining moments of my career and some of the key defining people of the path I've taken. And if I really started to think about it, I started to think about a lot of other women that I worked with that were colleagues or even in school, fellow students, a lot of strong women that I've worked with that have sort of set great examples for me over the years.
Can you give me an example of one of those women?
For example, there was another woman that started in the same role as me at Molson in this production trainee program. And I think when you are working around other women doing the same thing, it is not an issue. It becomes not something you think about anymore. And I know having International Women's Day and this discussion anyway is sort of a moment to highlight women in the industry. But at the same time, I would like it to be a place where it's not something we even talk about, you know, where it just is what it is. And I don't really want to see myself as some kind of, I don't want to be an activist in industry or women in science or technology, but, you know, I would hope that other women see myself and fellow, you know, women in the industry, what we're doing and see that there are no barriers to it, really. So I think it's just, I'm going to talk about some of the key relationships I've had and the impact they've had on my career. And as I said, I don't really want to be an activist but I would like, you know, I would like to be a role model.
How so?
Just as an example of, she's doing it. I can do it too.
Thank you so much for taking the time to have this interview and to chat with me, Julia, and wish you all the best with your story that you're going to share, and I'm sure everybody will love it.
Great. Thank you very much.
Take care, Julia.
Yeah, you too.
Thanks.
Thank you, Rohit. Now we have Emily Blake's piece on the pro-life protest on campus and student reaction. We want to warn listeners that this piece contains content that may be offensive to some viewers. On Thursday, Emily spoke with UBC art history student Ilana and Veena Pasi, president of the Art History Students Association, about their petition that UBC should have notified students. She also spoke to Irene D'Souza, an executive member of UBC Lifeline, the campus pro-life club, about her take on the issue and the intent behind the protest. Finally, she spoke to pro-choice protester and UBC student Jesse Schwartz.
The petition essentially is about having UBC allow us as students to know when certain things are happening, like a pro-life protest, really. So UBC never told us that they were coming. In fact, they just showed up yesterday. And then this morning, after we moved them from the Lacerre building, they got an email this morning at 8:30 a.m., faculty and staff saying that they were now going to be moved in front of the library. So as students, we've had no time to organize a protest. We've had no background knowledge of this happening, but yet we know about when filming's happening all throughout campus weeks before. We see signs and posters, but we don't know when something like this that's psychologically traumatic for certain individuals is happening.
It was a fact that right in front of our building, it felt like our department was crossing a picket line when we were just simply wanting to go to class. And it was because we do study visual language and we understand the implications of it. Seeing genocide, which is the most horrific action in humanity, juxtaposed with images of what they called Canadian genocide, which was just an image of abortion, is just absolutely disgusting, and it's a hate crime. There's no room for a swastika in front of that building or at UBC or anywhere in general, and there's no room for the yellow badge, and there's no room for Cambodian killing rooms. It's just, it's not a constructive way to get your message out. It's actually just a hate crime, and that's what our biggest issue was. And everyone is entitled to their opinion, but when it becomes a hate crime, that is where we draw the line.
Today they've removed those posters. Yeah. What are your thoughts on that?
We're really happy that though that imagery is removed. Our issue now is with UBC in general for allowing this to take place, and just as she said before, for not giving students any notice. Why is it when filming happens, everyone is notified of that, but this is people's real lives? Like, people can be triggered about this. And on top of that, there is no signage of what UBC offers in terms of counseling services. We had the SAC come to us and tell us to the anti-protest to tell us on a 15-minute loop, please tell students that if they are triggered by these images or by what is happening on campus, to please seek help and counseling services. So now our issue is not with them, though I do not agree by any means that this should be a UBC club. They are entitled to their opinion. Everyone is entitled to their opinion, but now our issue is with UBC, and UVic has banned these types of things. Why is UBC not doing that?
So who is your protest going towards, and how many signatures do you need?
Our protest is going towards the Dean of Arts and hopefully the President of UBC, Martha Piper. We've tried to go to their offices, and we keep running in circles, it feels like. It's just like, you send an email to this person, go send an email to this person, and nothing is moving. We're just trying to get as many signatures as possible. Yesterday we got over 200, and today we're hoping to do even more, because as many students that express that this is not right, it's just better. And hopefully that the Dean of Arts and the President of UBC will listen to our pleas and will make sure that this never happens. But I don't know an exact figure.
And who's organizing the petition?
It was just kind of me for a bit, because it was directly in front of our building. And as an undergrad rep, I didn't want the students I represent to have to face that imagery before they're just going to class. And certainly our professors were out there protesting with us because they thought it was a hate crime as well. And eventually, and with great appreciation, Pride came out, Pro-Choice Club, the Women's Center brought a lot of resources, so it just became this amazing coalition of everyone standing together in one unified cause.
Is there anything you wanted to add?
I just wanted to add, if this was a protest for something that was saying we don't want foreigners in Vancouver, we don't respect gay rights, they shouldn't have the option to get married, they shouldn't have these rights, this would be shut down within 2 minutes. But when it comes to women's rights or anyone's rights, any human, like trans women that have had abortions or support this, evidently it becomes this issue where everyone feels that their opinion is valid, when in fact it's not. And while I do respect that everyone has an opinion and is thinking and engaging with current events, I just can't understand why women's health or anyone's health and abortion is something that is so easily dismissed.
We're here because we want to expose the injustice of abortion as a human rights violation.
And so what has been the reaction by other students walking past so far?
So we've only been here for 2 days. And I've had mixed reactions, actually. So yesterday we had a lot of people very angry, very upset. We actually had a lot of people who didn't agree with our views, but were happy we were there to uphold free speech on campus, which I found very, very motivating and uplifting that we can uphold free speech on campus, because a lot of campuses are restricted in that in some capacities. And so I'm very fortunate. I want to thank our university for upholding that freedom of speech that we have on campus, which is a beautiful thing in a free country and democratic country. I've had people who have come up just asking me and wanting to know why we're here, and after dialoguing with them have, you know, either agreed or changed their minds. I've had people who just want to say, like, hey, I disagree with you, but tell me what you're doing. I've also had people who are said, we don't want to hear what you have to say, but just want to insult me, which, you know what, it comes with the territory, right? So mixed views on campus, which is what we have in a multicultural, diverse campus as UBC.
So why is this an issue that's personally important to you?
Well, I think it should be important to everyone. If we believe in human rights for all human beings, then we can see that a subsection of our human beings are
being violated, right? Their lives are being violated. So it's important to me because I want to uphold the dignity of every human life from all stages. And science tells us that the preborn are human, therefore they should get human rights.
And what would you say to the argument that autonomy over someone's body is a human right?
Well, I do believe in the autonomy of your body. That is another human's body. And so where I do have autonomy, my bodily autonomy ends when someone else's bodily autonomy begins, right? So, for example, I can drink as much as I want, but I can't drink and drive because I could hurt someone else's body. So in the same way, our bodily autonomy should end when someone else's bodily autonomy begins.
You were talking about how science justifies when human life begins, but I think there's some argument about when life actually begins. What would you say to that?
Well, all embryology textbooks, if you look across the board, tells you when a new life begins. The quotes we're actually using are from UBC's medical textbook that they use in our medical schools. So I would like to ask a question that if something is growing, isn't it alive? We could say yes. And if two species reproduce, what are their offspring going to be? They're going to be following after the species of their parents. So we can know from a certain point exactly when your life begins. Because prior to that, as a sperm or just an egg, you're not a human. You're a human part. But we know that from the moment of sperm-egg fusion, you're a fundamentally different being doing different things that a sperm doesn't do on its own or an egg doesn't do on its own.
So is your goal to have abortion legal, made illegal?
Our goal today on campus is to educate the public as to what abortion is, to make abortion unthinkable. Because if abortion is unthinkable, yes, ultimately the goal would make abortion illegal.
Do you think are there some cases when it should be allowed?
I don't think there's any circumstance in which abortion should be allowed.
What about cases if the person was sexually assaulted or if bringing the child to term would be harmful for them or the baby?
I've actually personally known people who have been raped, and I think rape is an awful thing, and I think the perpetrator should be punished severely for their crimes. And I think we should surround that woman with help and healing and all the comfort and support that she needs. However, if we don't even give the death penalty to the guilty rapist, why then do we give it to the innocent child? So yes, I believe that we should support that woman and give her all the help that she needs, but not at the cost of someone else's life. Can you repeat the second question?
So there are some cases where bringing the child to term is harmful to the pregnant person's health or harmful to the life of the child.
Mm-hmm. So there's actually no medical reason that abortion is necessary. So, for example, if you have an ectopic pregnancy where the child is implanted into the fallopian tube instead of the uterus, where abortion is the direct and intentional killing of the child, the right thing to do would be to direct it at the problem, which is the fallopian tube. So you'd have a surgery that cuts up that section of the fallopian tube. So you save the mother's life. The child may die as a result, but that's because of unfortunate circumstance, which is different than the direct and intentional killing of another human person.
So yesterday, I know you had some extra posters up that were comparing abortion to genocide, and there's a lot of controversy raised about that. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, so while the comparison to abortion to genocide is valid, we found that in our conversations with people, it was distracting to what we were trying to talk about, which is abortion as a human rights violation. So while the comparison is valid, we thought that to direct the conversations, to make it more focused and direct, that we'd leave those images out for today just so we can hone in on what we were actually trying to achieve, which is abortion as a human rights violation.
Does your group have any concern over the fact that the images that you have, whether it be the genocide images or the images of aborted fetuses, that they might be triggering or upsetting to students?
Yeah, and I recognize that many people have been touched by abortion, and it's a very sad reality that we live in. And I agree that a lot of these images might be triggering to women, men, friends. We don't know the extent of how many people have been touched by abortion. And while I recognize that fact, we have the lives of certain humans over the feelings of others. So when I have the lives in the balance, I want to help to save the lives of children and as well address the feelings of post-abortive women and post-abortive men. We have crisis pregnancy cards that we've been giving out, resources for counseling that we've also been giving out when need be, when those situations arise. So yes, we're not saying that we don't recognize that there are people who are affected by abortion. We do. We also think that it's very important, though, that we expose this injustice so that this doesn't happen.
Why was it important for you to come out and protest this pro-life display?
Actually, when I showed up, there wasn't a protest. We walked by and saw that they had this. I was actually going for lunch. I couldn't believe it, like, right on Main Mall. So basically, we stopped and wanted to do something because there was no counter-protest at this point. Mostly because the university didn't tell, like, the women's group or anybody that this was happening, so there was actually no chance to organize a counter-protest or any other information other than the stuff that the pro-life folks have put out today. So we wanted to have a presence because otherwise there would be none. So,
And if you could tell me about the poster that you have right now.
Sure. So it just says, against abortion, don't have one. And then I have these two others, My Body, My Choice, and Not on Our Campus. And I think that's kind of like the take home for me today is like Not on Our Campus. To me, this is borderline hate speech. They shouldn't be allowed to be here with these triggering images. Think about campus as a safe space for women, considering like all the sexual assault stuff that's been happening on campus. You know, 2 days ago was International Women's Day. And we have women who, you don't know what their experiences are. They're walking by, they're being triggered by these images that aren't helping a dialogue. Like, no woman who's considering, you know, what to do with unplanned pregnancy is going to come by and see pictures of, like, tortured fetuses and feel supported. All they're doing here is trashing women and making this an unsafe space for women on campus, and it's unacceptable. The UVic, University of Victoria, has banned this kind of crap already. UBC should follow suit. It's just completely unacceptable that this is here in the middle of the day on campus.
What would you say to people that say it's important to have them here just because of free speech?
I would say that free speech only goes so far. There are certain things that our laws don't allow people to do. Like earlier, they had pictures of swastikas and they were comparing abortion to genocide and the Holocaust. They had pictures of people, like black people being lynched, and comparing women's right to choose to all these different things. And I would say that, you know, free speech is a constant conversation, but it doesn't allow people to just promote hate and promote violence towards women. That's basically what this is. You know, if there was a group of neo-Nazis protesting on campus, you can imagine that UBC wouldn't give them permission to be here. Like, UBC is allowing this to happen.
Do you think that any of what they're promoting is misinformation?
Yes. I mean, all they have is pictures of dying babies. And even on their sign, it says, Planned Parenthood, butcher your baby. Like, if that's not misinformation, I don't know what is. They're not talking about reasons why women have abortion. They're not talking about the right to choose. They're not talking about the fact that women are legally allowed to have abortion in Canada. And there's guys here. There are men here. This guy over here was lecturing me. He was lecturing me on what I should be allowed to do with my own body. Anyways,
can I ask what he said?
He said that that if I can't make an ethical decision, then someone should step in.
So it seems like this sort of counter-protest was put together pretty quickly.
Yeah, it was put together by women and men. We've had, like, lots of awesome, like, self-proclaimed allies walking by and saying, oh, hell no. The fact that we didn't have notice is problematic because we don't have their fancy signs, and these are funded by the Center for Bioethics, which is if you Google them, they're a really problematic organization that lobbies for, like, pro-life and misleading information. They have a name that doesn't sound like they're pro-life. But so they have these, like, professionally paid for signs, whereas we, like, on the fly had to make all these signs with, like, pieces of paper and old cardboard. So yeah, I mean, I think that people just did it out of necessity. Like, we couldn't just stand here and allow them to do this without any sort of opposition, because they're in the minority and what they're doing is offensive and it's wrong and it shouldn't be allowed. Oh, UBC, shame on you. Get rid of them. I feel unsafe on my own campus, and that is not okay.
Thank you, Emily. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Timmy, your friends are here to see you. Get off the computer, will you?
Hey, Timmy, do you want to come out and shoot hoops with us at the park?
You know what? I'm actually busy playing on the computer right now.
Whatever. You never come out to play with us anymore. Let's go, guys.
30% of young adults are prone to stroke, and this statistic is on the rise. Stroke prevention starts early.
Are you sure you don't want to play? My cousin's in town and he's playing too.
Strokes can be prevented by regular exercise, a healthy, balanced diet, and sleeping well.
You know what? I'm coming too. Wait up for me, guys.
Follow UBCHSF on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook for regular tips on healthy living.
Strong heart, strong start.
Do you like laughing, hilarity, radical thought-provoking creativity, and laughing? UBC Improv is UBC's home for improvisational comedy, theater made up on the spot. Like us on Facebook to learn when our next shows are. Search for us on YouTube for our film sketches. And follow us on Twitter because we want the followers. UBC Improv. Insert cheesy slogan here. Let's get it on. Sugar,
let's get it on. Thank you, Rohit. To finish off this episode, we have News 101's financial correspondent. Oh, I'm sorry about that. Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Now we have News 101 correspondent Rohit Joseph's interview with Darren Dahl, Senior Associate Dean of Faculty at UBC's Sauder School of Business and a professor of the school's Marketing and Behavioral Sciences Division. Dahl is one of the co-authors of a study which found it found if ethical shopping is funded by welfare checks, those shoppers are judged as immoral for taking advantage of public generosity.
Why specifically pick the United States?
Well, largely because they have strong opinions on the notion of welfare, and this is where we were seeing these types of restrictions pop up. We haven't seen the same type of phenomenon in Canada, as example, though it is possible that these types of attitudes do exist among Canadians. We haven't tested that specifically, but in the U.S., it just seemed to be an interesting or a fertile ground to test these types of questions.
So what was the most startling finding for you as a researcher?
Well, a couple things. Number one is looking at the mechanism or why this happens. And what we found was that the reason, you know, society or people on average would look down on someone on welfare buying these types of products was because they felt, you know, these individuals didn't earn the right to. They didn't earn the money. So when we looked at, you know, other people that didn't have income resources, so, you know, you could say poor people, but that had earned the money, you know, you didn't get the same negative attributions. It was only when, you know, you had received the money from the taxpayer that you would be perceived as in a negative way. And the other interesting thing that we found was that this extended to organizations. So one of the last studies we did was people would judge, you know, a charity in a negative way if they were helping people by giving them organic or fair trade, these types of products. So the effect didn't just localize on individuals, but also on organizations that were providing welfare recipients with these types of products.
That's actually what caught my eye most interestingly is that it's extended to organizations. Why do you think that is?
Well, it again comes down to the dollars, right? In that, you know, these dollars, as an organization, you should be spending them not on products, you know, that are more expensive. Yes, they're probably better for society, but, you know, you're giving them to people on welfare. Therefore, you should be more judicious with your dollars.
Even if these organizations are not using taxpayers' money, this is for non-governmental, right?
Yeah, but this is still money that you're using that was given or donated or whatever by me, the taxpayer, if that makes sense. So the whole fact is these individuals didn't earn that money. They were given that money, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Don't you spend my money on what some people, and this is also kind of interesting, what some people would say is, you know, frivolous or extravagant or not always necessary in terms of organic.
You were saying earlier that although this hasn't been tested in Canada, it's possible. What are your personal thoughts about why there might be a difference between Canada and the U.S., or if there is a larger difference?
Well, it comes down to how we view the notion of welfare, and obviously in the U.S., you know, welfare, the perception that a lot of people on welfare are just lazy and they just need to go get a job, you know, those types of stereotypes, which, you know, aren't really true, you know, those are much stronger in the U.S. than in Canada. And Canada has a much longer and a perhaps one could argue more robust history of the notion of a social safety net. And so I think the notion of welfare and helping people in this way is a little bit more amenable or a little more acceptable, you know, to a Canadian taxpayer. That being said, you know, I do think you'd get, you know, some segment of the population would share the similar perceptions that we picked up in the U.S. There's a lot of variability on this, right? Not everybody's going to have the same view, but when you look, you know, on the average, these effects do show up quite strongly in the U.S.
In the U.S., did you manage to get a broad geographical sampling? Because, of course, the attitudes would range depending on the region, I would assume.
Mm-hmm. So the studies were run in a number of locations, so in Arizona, in Michigan, and then we've run studies also using the MTurk panel, which is a broad cut of America. So it's fairly robust as an average point, but I agree with you. I think in some states you're probably going to get a stronger effect than in others, you know, and I think we could guess what that would be based on the stereotypes that we have of these specific states. But, you know, we didn't test that, but I think that would be a reasonable hypothesis to make. But until you did it empirically, I think we always have to be careful, but I think your intuition is correct here.
Seeing as you're coming from a marketing background, what would the use be for companies, or I guess organizations, charities, with this research? How do you think they might respond or adapt?
Well, sir, first off, I think just having an awareness that these types of attitudes exist is very valuable to charities and organizations that are working with welfare. So, you know, knowledge is empowerment. So first off, it's a good idea to have an awareness that these effects exist. And second, it speaks to charities in terms of how they do their messaging. So, you know, if they are buying fair trade or organic and see value in those types of choices, you know, making sure that, you know, the people that donate and interested parties, you know, see the value in doing so, number one, and two, you know, playing with things that can reduce the effect, like price, for example, and saying, you know, we are buying organic, but it's the same price as if we buy, you know, full-fat hamburger, so to speak. And then it becomes much more acceptable to a donor to say, well, look, I mean, it's the same price, I'm getting the same bang for my buck. We should obviously choose organic because there's no disadvantage on the dollars at all. And so by being aware of these types of effects and the attributions that exist, you know, it helps the charity with their messaging and how they actually appeal to consumers that might have these concerns.
And speaking of then the consumers, the individual consumer, do you have any hope or ideal that your research might influence them in any way?
Well, I mean, obviously that would be really positive too. I think being aware that these stereotypes and attributions exist is the first part of the equation, so to speak. And once people, you know, are aware of these things and think a little bit about it and ask themselves, okay, is this good or is this bad? And I can't say which way they're going to go. I think awareness of the fact that this happens is clearly the first thing that you want to get out there. And then people can make up their own mind and hopefully think a bit about it. So I think when you think a little bit about it, you can then have a good debate in your head, or certainly with people, friends, spouses, colleagues, whatever the case may be.
Just to close things off, bringing it back to, you know, Canada, and particularly in Vancouver, there is definitely inequality. So mm-hmm. What can we take as a community here in Vancouver? What can we take from this research?
Well, I mean, at a more macro level, you know, inequality does create attributions. And so we are going to have opinions and stereotypes of any type of group, right? Mm-hmm. And being aware that stereotypes can be a very bad thing, right? And sometimes they lead, you know, to conclusions and things that we do that may not be in the best interest of society as a whole.
We certainly have stereotypes here about the downtown east side, for example.
100%. And you know, how true those are, you know, I think it's on us to truly try to understand and maybe spend some time to get better informed. And I think, you know, that could be a message here in this market is, you know, this type of research, yes, done in the U.S., has some application here, may not be the exact same, but it makes the point that, you know, attributions and stereotypes do have meaningful outcomes. And being aware and having a better understanding of as you said, you know, an impoverished group like the Downtown East Side is going to benefit society and benefit individuals.
All right. Thank you so much, Darren. Is there anything you'd like to add for our listeners?
No, I think it's great that the station is interested in some of the research coming out at UBC and definitely enjoyed the conversation and thank you for asking great questions.
Oh, no problem. Thank you, Darren.
Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.
And thank you, Rohit. To finish off this episode, we have News 101's financial correspondent, Alex Norman, bringing you his latest financial update.
This is the weekly financial update report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets. These are this week's top stories. Bank of Canada to leave the overnight rate unchanged. Deutsche Bank cuts bonuses by 17% in 2015. GM acquires Cruise Automation for driverless car software. And a food recall has been issued by Starbucks. We begin today's news with the Bank of Canada's decision on Wednesday to keep the Canadian benchmark interest rate unchanged as the central bank waits to see what Ottawa's plans are for stimulating the economy in its forthcoming federal budget. The central bank kept its benchmark target rate at 0.5%, saying in a statement, quote, "In the near term, outlook for the economy remains broadly the same as it did in January." The Bank of Canada cut its benchmark rate twice last year in an attempt to stimulate the Canadian economy, which has been hit hard by tanking oil prices. In January, the central bank lowered its economic projections for this year down to 1.4%. A Bloomberg analyst on Wednesday was noted saying, quote, "The central bank is okay with waiting on the sidelines to see what the government has up its sleeve before choosing to tinker with the lending rates again." If you were expecting that big bonus from Deutsche Bank, you may want to hold off on that new backyard pool. Deutsche Bank cut employee bonuses by 17% last year, citing a challenging 2015. The bank also warned that 2016 is off to a rocky start due to continued financial volatility. The German bank said its bonus pool for 2015 cost $2.7 billion, a drop of 17% even as staff has grown by 3%. The cutbacks come as Germany's largest bank has embarked on a massive multi-year reorganization and cost-cutting scheme that will include the sale of non-core assets like its stake in the Hue She Bank in China. Deutsche Bank plans to sell its full 20% stake in the Hue She Bank in a transaction that's supposed to be valued as high as $4 billion. Deutsche Bank officials noted that, quote, "European banks are facing more serious hurdles than U.S. banks as they continue to grapple with negative interest rates and the threat of rising legal costs tied to European regulatory probes." U.S.-based shares for Deutsche Bank were up today, closing at $20.62 for a 7.1% gain. The battle for driverless car technology heightens as General Motors comes in swinging. General Motors Co. is increasing their position in the driverless car market by acquiring San Francisco-based company Cruise Automation, Inc., a maker of technology that GM hopes will allow them to compete with Google in their race to develop self-driving cars. Quote, "GM has been watching the company for almost 2 years as it tests self-driving cars on the streets of San Francisco. By combining GM's work on autonomous cars and its manufacturing capabilities with Cruise's software, we hope we are able to get this technology to the market sooner," said GM President Daniel Ammann. Ammann continued by noting that GM will keep developing the company's Super Cruise semi-autonomous system that will debut next year. Shares in GM were up today, closing at $31.30 for a 1.52% gain. "I would think twice about ordering that breakfast sandwich with your next chai latte." A less serious scare has forced Starbucks suppliers to recall sausage, egg, and cheese breakfast sandwiches. The issue was discovered during a routine testing that uncovered the presence of Listeria monocryogens in the production facility. No illnesses have yet to been reported, and Starbucks is investigating the incident in close cooperation with the Food and Drug Administration and the Massachusetts Department of Health. According to the FDA, Listeria is particularly dangerous when it comes to young children, elderly people, and pregnant women. The recall affects 6-ounce packages of sausage, egg, and cheddar cheese on English muffin breakfast sandwiches, wrapped in clear plastic labeled "Best Before the 7th of August, 2016. Products may have been shipped up to 250 Starbucks locations in Arkansas, Texas, and Oklahoma, and sold to customers between March 3rd and 7th. A Starbucks spokesperson told Fortune in a statement that the company has removed the products immediately after being informed of the potential contamination. Shares for Starbucks were up today, closing at $57.59 for a 0.12% gain. In other market news, Toronto's S&P/TSX Composite Index was up 1.07% to close at 13,522 points. The broader S&P 500 index stayed relatively flat today, with a gain of 1.64% to close at 2,222 points. The Nasdaq closed higher today with a gain of 1.75%. In the European markets, the German DAX closed up today 3.51%.